Hello and welcome to the Capitol Record podcast brought to you by National Review. I am your host, David Bahnsen, and we are very blessed to be joined once again, a repeat visitor with Capitol Record. For my purposes, the best research analyst out there in matters of public policy and legislative endeavor, and this is Dan Clifton of Strategus Research. Dan, welcome to the Capitol Record.
David, thank you for having me on. I very much appreciate that kind introduction. Lots to talk about today with the election and what could happen afterwards.
Yeah, there sure is. And so hopefully by now, listeners, you figured out the reason we have Dan on today is because of the timing. We're now at a point, you know, if we had done this the day after the election, Dan, I think it'd be a little more limiting because we knew that next day that things did not go well for the Republicans. But I don't think we knew exactly where some of the margins were going to come in, the Senate, the House side. Even as we're recording now, it's Wednesday, the 16th of November. I'm willing to go on a limb and say that the Republicans are going to win the House by 7 votes, but I could be off plus or minus by 4. Give or take, you think? What is the range right now you would say at this point?
I would say they have a chance of winning 7 to 9. I mean, there is a chance that they win 11, but I think we're ranging in 7 to 9 seats. You're talking about probably the smallest Republican House majority since the 1930s, regardless of what number you fall on.
Now, with that said, let me play devil's advocate. I think that there's really almost no way to spin any of it as anything other than a pretty unmitigated disaster for the Republicans across the board. We'll Senate, this, that. There's certain particular seats. We can talk about some New York congressional pickups. You know, there's a couple things, surprisingly, here in California that have gone well. So both of my states, which are big blue states, actually kind of saw a couple little Republican pickups. But more or less, it's a disaster. However, I guess, is there a sense in which it's fair to point out that the 2020 House activity, where the Republicans gave away the White House, an incumbent Republican lost to a Democrat challenger, yet the Republicans had a net pickup of 15 seats in the House? Isn't that such an ahistorical event that it sort of alters some of the math of how we're viewing these midterms?
There's no doubt, David. What happened in 2020 is very unprecedented. It is very, very rare for a candidate to lose the presidential race and for his party to gain seats in the House of Representatives. Republicans gained 14 seats last year. Now, a president, on average, David, loses about 29 or 30 seats in their first House, their first midterm election. And so if you took that 14 and you lost another 14 now, you'd be at that average. But you're not there. You're at half of that. You're at 14 plus 7. So that means you're at 21. I look at it a little bit differently. Midterm elections are generally referendums on the first term president. We know this because the president's approval rating is highly correlated to the number of seats that president loses in the first midterm election. And the president's final Gallup number going into this election was 40%. That means that he should have lost 47 seats. Now, that wasn't our forecast, but our forecast was closer to 30 seats. And what it comes out to is, let's just say it's 7. That means there's a 40-seat delta between what his approval rating was saying and what he actually lost. He defied history because no other president was anywhere even close to that level of deviation. And so you say, well, why did that happen? President Obama lost President Obama lost voters who somewhat disapproved of his performance by 40 points in the 2010 midterm election. And Joe Biden won those voters by 4% this time. So that means that Biden has essentially turned this race from a referendum into a choice election. And you can go through issue by issue, race by race. And what you saw is that if you had any inclination of talking about what happened in that 2020 election, being associated with Donald Trump, you probably got punished in this election. And if you were on the other side of that, like Governor Kemp or Governor DeWine or Governor Sununu, you overwhelmingly won those voters who somewhat disapproved of Joe Biden's performance. And the takeaway is that voters were very discerning this election cycle. That's actually very good news. Candidate quality matters. But that is what is the driving heart of what happened on Tuesday night and why the traditional fundamentals of a wave election or Biden's low approval rating did not translate into what you normally would expect.
So I'm a little, I'm in a tough position here because I agree with every single thing you said, but everything you said is also what I want to be true. And I'm objective enough and I think professional enough analysis to know that cognitive dissonance and bias syndrome can kick in. I think you have a reputation, and I think it's well earned, for calling balls and strikes, for being quite objective. Sometimes you have to present information that may not be what you want to be the case. It does seem that despite the fact that what I am hearing from you is what I happen to believe, it seems obvious to me. That and the counter, there aren't counterfactuals. And what I mean by it is this. The governor in Nevada is now Republican. And the governor in Nevada won by a few points. So what I mean, there was a good little margin. Adam, who by the way is Adam Waxel, is a client of our firm and a very good friend of mine. And I wholeheartedly endorsed his candidacy and I hosted a fundraiser for him in our office. And have been financially involved with Adam for years, even in his governor race. But, you know, Adam did run pretty close to Trump. He sought his endorsement. He got it. He was involved in the legal team in Nevada. And let's say he's going to lose by maybe 800 votes. The governor won as a Republican challenger. Is that the only Republican challenger governor to have won in the whole country?
Every single governor won re-election. Except in Nevada, right? So, okay. So you have 27.
And so not just the only Republican challenger, the only challenger, period.
Only challenger. Okay.
So that's a second theme, by the way, besides good candidates mattering, your important theme here, not being connected to craziness, whether it's radical wokeism or election denial, radical Trumpism. The other theme is incumbency. Incumbents just flat out didn't lose. And I have to point out, people can say that the challenging party in Fetterman won over the incumbent party in the race against Oz in Pennsylvania. But Pat Toomey would have won that race running away.
No doubt.
And so that's a retirement, not an incumbency challenge. But the point I'm making is in Nevada, you can't on the same ballot have a Republican win by a few points for governor and lose a little in a close race for Senate without the explanation you're providing about proximity to Trump and election, so forth. And then even in Georgia, Brian Kemp, I just think that the margin of that victory relative to the runoff that Herschel Walker faces, it really speaks to the point you're making.
Absolutely. And what you have to do is look, if you didn't think Biden was doing a good job, you voted Republican. And if you thought Biden was doing a good job, you voted Democrat. 10% of the electorate thought Biden wasn't doing a good job, but they weren't pounding the table on that. Those 10% of voters made the difference. And the gap between Kemp getting those voters and Herschel was like 30 points. The gap between J.D. Vance and DeWine, J.D. Vance won, was still pretty wide. Okay, so we now know who the marginal voter is who made the big difference. And this, by the way, was apparent in the August special elections that happened. We had five special elections in August for House races under the existing districts. The Republicans underperformed their 2020 results in all five of those special elections. And we wrote a note. And we were like, if the election was held today, the Democrats would have control of the House. So it was there. But what was different in October than August is that the data for the Republicans got really strong. The Republicans won the national vote by 3-5% when this all nets itself out, maybe 3-4% when it all nets itself out. That should be a 30-40 seat majority. And the investment implication of that is that if the Republicans won 30 or 40 seats in this House race, they've probably locked in their majority in 2024 as well, which means I now have certainty on energy regulation, on drug pricing, on tax increases, on, you know, you can pick your issue. And that's why you've seen a meaningful decline in defense stocks, biotech stocks, energy infrastructure stocks over the last 7 days, because some of that certainty or expected certainty is just not there. And so Nancy Pelosi.
And do you also believe you're applying that, Dan, to the House? On the Senate side, yeah. If the Republicans had won, forget New Colorado, Washington, which was always a pipe dream.
Yep.
But if they had kind of won what was the best realistic sense, which was Nevada. Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, Pennsylvania. So we're at 53. And then you go into 2024 where the Democrats have a much tougher hill to climb. Is 60 Senate seats and a filibuster-proof Republican Senate then on the table? And is it now not even remotely on the table?
Well, it all depends what's going to happen in Georgia in terms of that extra one seat on December 6th runoff. But look at where the Democrats are defending. West Virginia. Joe Manchin won West Virginia in 2018 in a terrible state by just 3 points. A terrible year for Republicans.
He's done.
You got Sinema up again in Arizona. You got Tester up in Montana. And what is so interesting to me about this election that we can learn from 2024 is that when you look at the Senate election results today, the Republicans look like Trump and the Democrats look like Biden. We just literally had a proxy presidential race in a midterm year. And we're seeing an increasing correlation between presidential election results and what those Senate results are going to be. And the Democrats are defending a number of states that Donald Trump won in 2020. So at the very least, the Republicans are going to gain seats. The Republicans have a big year. They can get closer to 60, and the Republicans never get close to 60 in the Senate. Even if it's 55, 56, 57, man, that's a big win. And that's what the market had begun to anticipate, both in the House and the Senate. And a lot of that has declined somewhat based on these election
results. And not having for 6 years now, potentially four very winnable states, some of which Trump didn't win, but he was close in. They're just textbook battleground states, Pennsylvania, Nevada, Georgia, Arizona. Georgia, you know, you would think would have been more red, but they're dealing with some things there, obviously, in their electorate. But either way, it does seem 60s a reach, and it could still end up being a solid result in 24. How much of that, Dan, do you think, and this was my kind of contrarian take on Tuesday night, that maybe markets would love what happened for the reason I loved it, because we were still going to get gridlock, right? The Republicans are still going to win the House, albeit by a way lower margin than anyone thought. And yet there seems to me to be this just unmistakable lesson to the electorate that Ron DeSantis is the future and the present of the party, and that backward grievances from 2020 are not where the energy is, and that maybe now the Republican Party could grab a lot of the energy of Trumpism without the baggage of Trump and move forward with a pretty solid case to make to the electorate. Am I being overly optimistic that that will be the takeaway?
Look, we all have biases. What we try and do is use data and historical examples to say, where are we today? Right. So I could talk to you about the way the voters discern between Trump and non-Trump and quantitatively prove it. It's not my opinion. In the example that you're giving, it's more of a historical reference. In 1998, David, the Republicans were headed for a huge wave election. Bill Clinton had his personal issues. His approval rating was 40%. And in July of 98, the Republicans stood up and said, we're going to impeach him. And I have never seen the political environment turn on one political party like I did in the month of August of 1998. It is the only time a second-term president has ever gained seats in the first midterm, in their midterm election, their second midterm election. And when you think about that, Bill Clinton gained 5 seats in the House and the Republicans thought they were going to have a wave. Very similar to what you just went through, where the expectations and the result itself were both very disappointing. And out of there came good for the Republicans. What came out of there? A dissatisfaction with the existing party leadership. Newt Gingrich was removed immediately, replaced, okay? And then there was this governor in Texas who just won a second term, who got 60% of the Latino vote, 50% of the women vote, and was talking about a new type of Republican, a compassionate conservatism. Whether he wanted to or not, George W. Bush became the leader of the party on election night in 1998. And that may happen again this time around, where voters now had an alternative and they liked the alternative within the base. And what happened? The Republicans won everything in the 2000 election. Very different time, not exactly comparable. But I saw, because I worked for a moderate Republican governor at that time, and that governor knew on election night who was going to be the leader of the party. And that person may not have had the same ideology as George W. Bush, so to speak, but knew this is where the party was going. And that's why I think you see a lot of similar parallels. And while you're saying there could be some good that come out of this, I've seen this happen once before.
And I think the 98 example is wonderful. And there's even more similarity to this situation, because Bush had won in a very close election in 94 and then won by a huge margin when he beat Ann Richards in 98.
Totally.
And in Ron DeSantis' case, he won by a nail biter at first time, now won with much larger margin. And as you point out, there was such a big pickup in the black and brown vote in Florida versus 4 years ago. And obviously, the female vote, yep, but particularly certain counties, right? I think Bush in 98 did quite well, even in some of the big cities. Mm-hmm. And DeSantis's situation in Miami-Dade County is somewhat analogous. The difference is Trump, the persona of Trump just being around. And I was struck by the deja vu over the last week. Last night, as President Trump made the announcement that he's going to run again, I was seeing a lot of people on Twitter kind of retweet him and quote tweet him and seemingly provingly sharing some of his sentiments about, you know, certain things, foreign policy or America First agenda, stuff like that. And these were people that 5 or 6 days ago had been tweeting like, okay, we got to move on.
Yeah, sure.
You know, it's Ron after January 6th, I thought Trump was done and people were pointing that way. And then they just sort of came back. And there's some fear factor there that I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen people so afraid to just say what I know they think and what everyone else in the room thinks. And they just don't want to be the first to say it, that we might just be better off really moving on.
Yeah, listen, I'm not an anti-Trumper. I always gave him the benefit of the doubt of winning the primary in 2016 and winning the general election in 2016. Our job isn't to pick sides. We're trying to get to the outcome. And yep. I just think the difference here, though, is that you now have an alternative, and you haven't had an alternative up until this point. What that alternative is not a move away from Trumpism per se. It's to take Trump's policy objectives and put a level of competency on those policy objectives. I have just spent the past 12 weeks traveling through America, meeting with voters, political officials, high net worth individuals, and institutional investors. And my big takeaway from this, no matter who I was meeting with, was that there's a yearning for a cycle of competency. And I would talk about this in the 2024, you know, context while I was on the road, not realizing that voters were going to apply it in 2022, right? And that's basically what just happened. And so my sense here is that the party is shifting. This is not your father's Republican Party anymore. This is a more populist. It's definitely one that's not pro-business, so to speak. It's not anti-business, but it is a populist party that is trying to say we can handle a pandemic, we can handle a hurricane, and we can still deliver the policies that people have enjoyed. And that, to me, is the big shift that's going on. It also explains why Pennsylvania is less competitive for Republicans than Nevada is, because the nature of who's going to vote for the Republicans are going to be different. And increasingly, we're seeing higher income, higher educated voters moving away from the Republicans, and the Republicans doing better with Latinos and union workers. That is a major shift that's going on in U.S. politics. It may not have happened as big as people were expecting on election night, but it is in place. And that's why I think eventually you're going to wind up seeing the party move on. I don't know if Trump's going to be the nominee. I don't know if he's going to go independent. I don't know if you're going to have 10 Republican candidates in there. But I feel that there's a shift today that's different than when you had January 6th or these other near-death experiences of Donald Trump, so to speak.
Yeah, I see it the same way, Dan. I think that your point is really important, that right now, for our purposes, we're not necessarily trying to say which way we want it to go, finger on the scale type of thing. It's more about evaluating the lay of the land and what that may mean in certain aspects of markets and just macroeconomic considerations. And it does seem to me that a strategist theme for out of 2016 is back in play now, which is that personnel is policy. And I believed very strongly that there was a kind of unclear economic agenda in some of Trump's campaign, but that when he hired Larry Kudlow before Gary Cohn, Steve Mnuchin, I knew there was at least a supply side fabric in the administration, even if it wasn't fully intellectually absorbed the way it may have been in the early Reagan years, especially Reagan's first term. And mixing in a Pete Navarro and some of the more protectionist side, it didn't really throw off the fact that there was ultimately a supply side personnel policy. And combined with Kevin Brady, Paul Ryan, they got that monumental corporate tax reform done. What do you see in a DeSantis mode about personnel? That strikes me as, to your point, some of the policies could be the same, but there's more competency. But it seems that the competency is not just in technocratic skill, getting through a pandemic and a hurricane, leadership, but the personnel, that he can surround himself with people. I don't think President Trump is getting his old staff back. For the most part, I think that a lot that the DeSantis hope involves the idea of a whole new generation of other leaders, cabinet members, policymakers.
Yeah, I think that's true. And first, let me say, if Trump wins the primary, Trump will actually have a better time recruiting today than he did after he won in 2016. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, his protectionist views on China are now the accepted mainstream in both parties at this point. There's like no free traders left in Washington, for better or worse, right? So people will go in there and be like, I don't want to fight with Peter Navarro all day. Now that's going to be, that's sort of the accepted policy. And I do think it will be a little bit easier to recruit the next time around. That's number one. But where the policy intellectual heavyweights are going, and where you get a lot of the people who have experience working in that White House, they're going to be looking for alternatives. Those are going to be Glenn Youngkin. Those are going to be Ron DeSantis. Those are the kind of candidates that are really policy driven. I know this. Listen to what DeSantis is talking about. He uses the word adjusted gross income on the stump every day, right? And like I'm using this just as a kind of like an anecdotal example, but he's measuring his policies by how many people come into his state net and how much income he attracts in. That to me is a really great metric to be looking at, because he's saying, if I wasn't doing this right, people would be fleeing my state. And that's not what's happening. I just had the largest migration of wealth into my state during COVID than anybody has ever seen in world history. Now that's in nominal dollars, so you can do that. But my sense here is that he is very policy driven. And while he knows the most, he's also going to surround himself with people who are very good. You see that on his communication side right now. And there's no way that he could pump out the policies that he did. You also have to remember, he's not a rabid ideological governor. This is a guy who's been very good to teachers. This is a guy who was trying to import prescription drugs from Canada. that is not your typical free market Republican type of governor. We tend to forget what he was doing in the first 2 years of office. This is why he did really well. He governed for a broad swath of the population. He's got the dynamics to win the primary. He's got the dynamics to win a general election. Doesn't mean he's going to, but that's why you see people moving to him. My experience, he's going to have a lot of momentum. The people who are in the lead at the beginning end up not being the person who ends up being the nominee. So there's risk to that. But
yeah,
that's why people are gravitating to him. That's why he can get that kind of policy intellectuals that are have experience, that know how to move the needle, will likely try and join with his campaign.
So why don't we look into some of the policy aspects out of the midterms, even apart from kind of forward glancing at 2024 and beyond. Over the next 2 years, is it safe to say, before we talk about lame duck session, after the new House class is inaugurated, and let's assume for sake of argument that Herschel does lose in Georgia. That's certainly my view. You may have a different one. I'd be curious to hear if you have any predictions around that. But whether it's 50-50 or 51-49, we know that the Democrats have a voting majority. And my view is essentially they really weren't able to get much done in the first 2 years with a majority House. The so-called Inflation Protection Act and that infrastructure bill notwithstanding, the most severe things around Build Back Better, they were Manchined away. So now without a majority in the House, I just assume we're looking at total gridlock for the next 2 years. Am I wrong on the threat of potentially market-impactful legislation happening in the next 2 years?
Yeah, so first, we are going to move to gridlock. Gridlock is not a bad thing. The average return on the S&P 500 in a Republican House, Democratic Senate, Democratic President is 13.6% annually. That's not a forecast. It's just a historical pattern. And, you know, if you're not doing much in Congress, it allows the Fed to get their job done and get inflation out of the system. So that's a starting point. What are the Republicans going to do? The Republicans are going to do a series of what we call messaging bills to say to the American public, if you give us complete control in 2024, these are the policy initiatives that we would like to get done. The first will be immigration enforcement at the southern border. It has very little chance of moving in the United States Senate. The second is going to be on energy policy, the creating more incentives to drill, creating better incentives to distribute and transport oil and natural gas. Again, unlikely in that form to get somewhat done. And then they'll have investigation power where they can actually issue subpoenas and they can begin a series of investigations, big tech, Hunter Biden, you know, you can pick your stuff that they worry about. But when you have divided government like this, budgets have to pass, David. And when budgets have to pass, when you have the majority in both chambers, you can say, let's go and put immigration changes on that budget or energy permitting reform. And it's just harder to do without the Senate itself. What is different today goes back to your earlier comment that you have all these Democrats who are running in Trump states in 2024, and they may be looking for some level of accomplishment. So Senator Manchin has energy permitting reform. The president has endorsed Senator Manchin's energy permitting reform. So I wouldn't call it complete gridlock. There is a chance later in 2023, as we start to think about 2024, that you may see something like that pass. That's number one. Number two is that the Republicans are likely going to try and be out hawkish on China over Biden. There is wide agreement on this. And so the Republicans are probably going to try and do arms sales to Taiwan, and less unknown, but do the Republicans try and pass a bill that has declared independence for support for Taiwan independence? While that would not pass the Senate, that would have enormous implications of just the House considering something like that. And so there's always going to be a market impact by what we're doing in Washington, even if stuff is not getting passed by law. And I'm just trying to make that clear. And then third,
real quick on the on the Taiwan front, will the Republicans try to do that in the next 2 years for political messaging, grandstanding, or is there some policy meat on the bone there?
Well, I think it's both. The policy meat on the bone is Xi Jinping's going in there. China's going into Taiwan. We want to show them the support. The president walked away from his conversation with Xi Jinping yesterday, not of the belief that any attack on Taiwan was imminent. He could be wrong on that assessment, but that was the assessment that he walked out of there with. So the White House is going to be very much opposed to doing some sort of Taiwan independence bill because they think it's just going to re-flare. And what happened was that when Nancy Pelosi went to Taiwan, the Chinese showed that they could put a blockade around, they put a blockade around Taiwan. That's critically important. Because if you have a blockade, the weapons can't get to Taiwan. And you're basically taking Taiwan through attrition rather than through war. And if the Republicans saw something like that, because they're going to do arms sales, the arms sales can't get there, that may force them to wind up trying to do something on independence. So I just throw that out there for conversational purposes of how you can still be in gridlock and still have a market impact. Now, I've left out the elephant in the room and what's really going to matter. And that is the debt ceiling. Mitch McConnell said yesterday that it's very unlikely that we're going to deal with the debt ceiling in the lame duck session of Congress. As you know, Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, Treasury Secretary Yellen, they were hoping to get the debt ceiling up in the lame duck session of Congress so that we didn't have to deal with it immediately in 2023. The Democrats then looked at the idea of using budget reconciliation, which would allow them to raise the debt ceiling with 51 votes in the lame duck session of Congress. And Joe Manchin told them no this week. So that means that we're going to have to deal with the debt ceiling in 2023 if we don't do it in the lame duck. You have a interest cost on the debt that's about to explode in a very meaningful way, and a new small Republican majority saying, let's use the debt ceiling for leverage to get spending cuts into the system that a Democratic president's going to oppose. So budget trench warfare will be a theme in the second and third quarter of 2023 in this scenario. So pick your gridlock could be good, but gridlock can also lead to this kind of spinach outcome where we're going to have to kind of grind through on the debt ceiling next year.
So let's talk about the energy side for a minute. I've loved your notes since last week on Manchin and the idea of a lame duck, odds increasing with more leverage in the way the Senate unfolded. My take on it after the Inflation Reduction Act passed was that his promise from Schumer to get a vote on these things, I knew that there was going to be scuttlebutt from Bernie Sanders and some of the progressives who didn't like it. But I figured it was basically a Republican idea, better pipeline approval, more eliminate some of the silliness that is used to block certain state endeavors. And that even though everybody was mad at Manchin on the right, they kind of agreed with this one and that their votes would overcompensate his lost progressive votes. Turns out I was wrong, that there was kind of some punitive opposition to Manchin's idea from the right. Yep. Is your premise that now that punitive opposition will be gone?
Yeah, so I was very much of the view that we would not do energy permitting reform before the election for two reasons. The first is Mitch McConnell said that he would not bring the CHIPS Act up to the Senate floor as long as the Democrats were doing budget reconciliation. And David, as you may remember, after McConnell proved that he could block the CHIPS Act, Manchin came out and said, oh, I'm not for Build Back Better anymore, or Inflation Reduction Act, I'm just for drug pricing. And so we went through this whole kind of kabuki dance where we weren't doing anything other than drug pricing. And as soon as the CHIPS Act passed, which passed the Senate at like 12 noon in late July, within 2 hours, there was a 1,200-page bill and summaries for the Inflation Act. So that was a trick move by Schumer and Manchin to trick Mitch McConnell. And Mitch McConnell's like, now you need me for your energy permitting reform? I'm blocking this. That's number one. Yeah. Number two is that the bill, while in theory is similar to what the Republicans want, if you're a Republican and you think you're going to win the House and Senate, you know you can get better terms post-election. And yeah, so, right? And so now I look at that and I was like, okay, well, we're not doing it pre-election. Now it's post-election. Now we know the election results. And now Manchin's going to try one more time to put energy permitting reform in there. And he may not get the opportunity. We may not be able to do this this time around. But I think the odds of energy permitting reform are going up. There was also something else that happened that's changing our view. And that is that Saudi Arabia cut OPEC production 30 days before the election. And that took moderate Democrats like Mark Warner from Virginia and said, well, we can't be relying on anybody else. This energy permitting reform helps cite wind and solar, which is also subject to lawsuits by the environmentalists. So there's enough in there that you can wind up seeing a deal start to come together on energy permitting reform. And it may not be in a lame duck. The odds are definitely going up. But it may be in sometime next year where there's enough agreement that we need to do this. And that's why
in a second, in the second half of Biden's first term, even filibuster proof.
Yeah. So you would need 60 votes in the Senate to do this. And I think the votes are there to do this for the reasons that you mentioned. Ideologically, the Republicans are on board with this. There's enough Democrats that are on board. Bernie Sanders is never going to support it. Right. And
no,
there are other Republicans that may not support it. But you have 60 votes if you want to get this done. Yeah. Remember, we're not going to be able to fill or dump out oil out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve anymore. We're just basically out of oil.
And so one thing I want to point out, I know you know this, but I always want to make it clear for listeners. Yeah. We do this with Keystone Talk a lot, too. We start mixing up upstream and midstream. Sure. And there's a sense in which the general sort of persona in a policy, in an administration is all the same. Generally, if you're for drilling, you're for more pipelines.
Correct.
And if you're against pipelines, you're probably against drilling. But of course, they are separate things, right? Fast-tracking the permitting of the West Virginia pipeline has nothing to do with new oil production.
Correct.
It has to do with the way in which oil gets from the well to the refiner. And yet, it does seem as if it's political cover to say, I'm approving a new pipeline because Saudi Arabia is holding back supply, even though the new pipeline doesn't bring any new supply to market. Is your comment on Mark Walker more about the politics of it, or is he really not that informed here?
No. But by the way, it is the politics, okay. But it is also what that bill does. That bill changes the court, where the courts are going to hold any future pipeline permits. And it's going to move it to the D.C. Circuit, which is going to give a better or fairer type of ruling on pipeline siting than what they're currently getting. So it just doesn't – the Mountain Valley Pipeline is the sort of shiny object because that gets approved immediately with no court challenges permitted. But it also changes the permitting for future pipelines. Doesn't cure everything. You still have state problems and things like that. But it actually improves how you get the permitting done for future pipelines and solar and wind. And I think that's important. So it is a bit political. A lot of people are going to have tough elections in 2024. Energy prices are going to be elevated. This gives them a way to make it look like they're doing something. But substantively, this bill is an okay bill. It's not a perfect bill. It's an okay.
Well, I think that some of the details listeners would be fascinated to know. Right now, a federal agency, which you would expect to be the most bureaucratic and most green friendly and most problematic for some of the either pipeline or drilling projects, a federal agency can rule that they're all a go environmentally as it pertains to water impact. And then a state can come and say, no, we decided there's water concerns.
That's right.
And it's gamesmanship. It's not legitimate, but it's an effective bureaucratic way of blocking. And what this bill is doing is saying states can no longer play games around some of these concerns.
Absolutely.
This is something Republicans have wanted addressed for a long time.
Absolutely.
And Manchin's bill does address it.
Absolutely. And so this is why... Again, if we want to cook something up, we can because we have all the ingredients. And that's basically what I'm laying out. The irony is that divided government and election years actually do produce legislation. We have this view of this like silent Congress. You know, we did 10 bipartisan bills in the last 2 years while the Democrats had complete control.
Yeah.
All right. And so, it doesn't get a lot of attention when it happens, but it happens. And members of Congress are going to want accomplishments ahead of the 2024 election, especially with so many Democrats running in Republican states, especially with such a narrowly divided, very fragile House majority, that my sense is that the first year is all gridlock, budget, trench warfare. As you start to come out of that, people are going to look for accomplishments. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's a few accomplishments there.
So let me close this out with three quick questions. And I know you're going to have some perspective, but I think that they're, even though they're not connected to one another, they're all really relevant and interesting political dash economic implications. The whole theme we talked about from the midterms and what the takeaways were nationally, when you look to the congressional pickups in New York, is that a sort of subtext around crime, or was that gerrymandering in the Republicans' favor? Why did some congressional races go Republican in New York?
So we followed the Republican races very carefully, and we were very carefully watching the Republican governor's race. If you remember, in New Jersey a year earlier, a pretty bad Republican candidate almost beat an incumbent in a state with a million more Democrats than Republicans. So yeah. We already knew that demographic was there. You have a holdover temporary governor, and you have a political environment which should be moving away from that temporary governor's party. Lee Zeldin came in and ran a magnificent governor's race and turned the issue of crime almost identical to the way Youngkin turned education in Virginia a year earlier. And we never knew whether Zeldin was going to win or not, but we knew he was going to have coattails in those congressional races. And so that was part of us upping our House forecast, was like, oh, they're going to win New York. They're going to win 4 or 7 of these seats in New York. Those seats that they won, even with redistricting, those were Biden districts that the Republicans were winning. Biden districts. And they beat the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. This is a really impressive win in Rockland County. And what we think happened is that the crime issue and the execution of those races were just so much better than what you saw nationally. None of those candidates had any connection to the Trump issue, to the election denying issue. And they were running in hostile territory where it was not on the issue of abortion. They had a lot of abortion issue ads running against them, and they still did well. It confirms your first thesis, was that candidate quality matters and connection to the past versus the future matters. They were running on the future. I'm going to give you a society where you feel safer. I'm going to give you a society where your prices come down. This is how I'm going to do it. It's a model for what should be happening nationally for Republicans moving forward. But don't get me wrong. Those seats are extremely fragile in a presidential election where a Democrat wins that seat by 3 or 4%. Those are going to be hard seats to hold on. That's why the Republican majority is somewhat fragile right now.
Yeah. Second question, and it could be yes or no, because we're all just doing conjecture. Is Joe Biden going to be the nominee in 2024 for the Democrats?
No. I do think, though, that he runs the risk of freezing out the rest of the field. Let me give you an example. The U.S. intelligence agencies met with the Russian intelligence agencies in Turkey this week. They're trying to get an exit ramp for the Russia-Ukraine war. The president himself met with Xi Jinping in China at very heightened geopolitical events. If the president announced today that he is not running for president, would he have the leverage to be able to do these negotiations? So as long as he is a nominee or a potential nominee, he is not the lame duck, and foreign policy-wise, we're going to need it. He's also going to need a domestic policy as he negotiates with the Republicans over the debt ceiling. So I assume that we're going to play this game all the way till June of next year. By the time we get to June, there's going to be enormous pressure on Biden to make a decision one way or another, because at that point you run the risk of freezing out the rest of the field. And maybe that's what he wants if he wants to be the nominee. But you got all those Republicans running in red states. I mean, Democrats running in red states. There's going to be pressure for him not to be on the ticket once the glow of the midterm elections falls off. And by April, May, or June, I think that's when we're going to start to realize whether the Republican Party is consolidating around one candidate to challenge Donald Trump. Because if it's Pence and Cruz and DeSantis and, you know, pick your candidate, they're going to dilute the anti-Trump field. And what I think is happening now in Republican circles is this idea that you got to get behind one candidate and you got to go one-on-one with Trump. And that's the only real way you're going to beat him. And by then, we're going to have a clearer vision of that. If you have that vision, Biden's going to have to make a decision at the same time.
I think your list included Cruz in there. And I think that's where I would say, I think there will be multiple candidates that are there to oppose Trump. But as long as one of them is DeSantis, that's all that's going to matter. I think Pence can be a great foil to Trump. He's a man of real integrity and honor. And I don't think he's a viable candidate to win the nomination, but I definitely think he can disrupt Trump. Pompeo and some of the others, Nikki Haley, similar. But the issue is if you start getting people who are generally MAGA friendly, Cruz and DeSantis, that they could then dilute. But I do not believe that will happen. And so I'll put it out there on this talk with Dan Clifton in November of 22. I see Ted Cruz as the next Attorney General of the United States in a Ron DeSantis administration.
Interesting.
And I'll pretend I'm making that up, but maybe I have information here.
I love the way
my
you
final
think.
Question. Biggest market impact, midterm results, or Federal Reserve activity in 2023?
I think they go hand in hand, because what you're starting to see is that at the same time you got the midterm election results, you started to get better inflation numbers at the same time. And so both of those are going to lead to a pivot of what was working in the market overall. And so that's why you're starting to see this idea that, hey, defense stocks, which are up 30% this year, let's start fading them. Biotech, let's start fading them. Oh, and let's go into these high growth flying names. Now, I don't know if that's going to last, but you had these concurrent events. By the way, just Biden meeting with Xi Jinping was an important event for our clients, knowing that there's dialogue. Yes, the relations are bad. It's going to get worse, but at least they're talking. Again, why is that important? Dollar goes down. All three of these events were dollar negative after a very rising dollar. And that's going to change your asset allocation. Whether that holds remains to be seen. And at some point, we're probably going to have to pivot where we begin to think about, are we going to have a recession? You have all of the yield curves inverted, including the very important 3-month 10-year, and you have the leading indicators rolling over. Historically, that tells you you're going to get a recession. And so what we're going to see here in the lame duck is an effort to pass a big spending package, make sure that the tax increases don't go into effect, possibly give aid to consumers. The idea of doing more fiscal policy, which could complicate the Fed's job, is something that investors have not focused on. And in 2 or 3 weeks from now, they're going to have to be focused on this because the numbers are pretty shocking. I mean, you're looking at $100, $150 billion of additional fiscal aid, which is, you know, 1% of GDP at a time when most people think the fiscal spending from 2 years ago, which was a mistake, is now in the rearview mirror, and the Fed now has a clear path to get inflation out of control. That situation is going to get a little bit more murkier for investors. Is it offsetting the damage that the Fed's done, or is it going to make the Fed's job harder in 2023? And I just think at this point, the Democrats no longer care about inflation at this point. Not that they don't care, like, oh, that people's incomes aren't going up, but they see the announcements of the unemployment rate going up, and they're going to be more focused on growth and jobs then they're going to be on inflation. That's a pretty big change.
Yes, yes. Well, I appreciate all the perspective. I really know in this environment how busy you must be, and taking a few minutes to talk with us means a lot to me, Dan. I know it means a lot to our listeners, and would love to have you back again as we get deeper into 23 here on Capitol Record. But thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure being here today.
And thank you all for listening. We will go into our Thanksgiving week. We're going to post the Thanksgiving week Capitol Record a little bit earlier than normal. And I have a really, really wonderful conversation for you with Dr. Samuel Gregg of the Acton Institute and of AIER, who has a brand new book out, The Next American Economy. We're going to post that conversation next Tuesday. In the meantime, share this conversation with Dan Clifton far and wide. Strategus represents pound for pound the greatest macro research firm on Wall Street, and Dan's commentary on policy is a big reason why. Thank you, as always, for listening to the Capitol Record, and reach out anytime with questions, comments, and we will be back with you next week.